right. What's up, folks?
Yep.
Talking about an old movie. Mm. Going back to the 70s again.
Yeah.
This is the one that won the Patreon poll overwhelmingly. I mean, this one just, like, laid waste to all the other choices. And I'm glad because I can't actually believe that we haven't got around to talking about this movie yet, because this is a fucking classic.
It's a good movie. This is like kind of a, this is a masterpiece for its time.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, easily one of the best movies of the 70s, easily one of the best sci-fi movies ever made.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And we're talking about the 1978 version because there have actually been four direct adaptations of this.
Yeah.
If you didn't know, it's actually based on a book that came out in 1954, 1955 by Jack Finney that was called Invasion of the, or just called The Body Snatchers. I actually read the book a really long time ago. And, you know, so they made a film in 1956 directed by Don Siegel, who would famously go on to direct Dirty Harry. And that one's good too. I actually like that one. That one kind of has a more 50s suburbia idealized, either anti-communist or anti-McCarthyist kind of spin to it. I feel like the one, though, that came out in 1978, which is what we're talking about today, the one with Donald Sutherland and Leonard Nimoy, I kind of feel like this one is more, it's like less overtly political. I think it's like more generalized.
Yeah.
It's almost like a sociocultural kind of thing.
We're talking about mass movements. It's not some, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of like anti-groupthink. That's
and
really
interestingly, this movie debuted like not that long after the Jonestown Massacre. So I think a lot of people kind of saw it in that light, too, just like cult-like, kind of cult-like, any kind of conformity or anything like that. Because I think the original novel, Jack Finney came forward and he's like, I didn't have any particular political agenda. I was just talking about how scary it would be, like, if everyone was kind of, you know, sucked into this one mind, you know, groupthink kind of thing. And it's like you couldn't tell, like, who was your enemy and who is your friend, you know what I mean? So I feel like that's a really, you know, and the fact that there have been four adaptations just of that book, and there have been a bunch of other movies that were sort of similarly themed.
It's just a theme of everybody believes something you don't believe in and they're taking over.
And yeah.
How do you survive?
And I feel like you can relate to that. And it's kind of interesting. I found this other video. I can't remember the name of the guy's channel, but I've subscribed to it. And he has like a lot of really good like film analysis. And he went through every single adaptation, all four adaptations of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And he was talking about how each of them like reflected, you know, whatever the fears of whenever it was made was. So it's really kind of an evergreen story that you can sort of...
You can
reboot it in different ways and like cast your own stuff on it. Interestingly, I didn't know. I knew that there was one made in the 2000s with Nicole Kidman, which was just called The Invasion, which I heard wasn't very good. I don't think I've seen it. But I didn't know until today that there was another one that was just called The Body Snatchers. It was made in 1993 that was directed by Abel Ferreira, of all people. And I heard that one wasn't all that great either. Although I like Abel Ferreira movies, so maybe I should have. So I didn't even know he did that one. But anyway, the 1978 one I think is easily the best, adaptation of all the ones that they have made. So...
And it's kind of like the best a la Alien 1 and John Carpenter's The Thing. It's in there.
Yeah, it's like a paranoia.
Yeah.
I really, really like...
Acting's really good.
One thing that I like a lot about 70s movies in particular, and this one too, is that they really have this kind of... Man, it's like it's hard to put your finger on.
It's a feeling of alienation through these damn movies.
Yeah, this one almost comes across as like a little bit of a conspiracy theory, conspiracy thriller type of thing. And I feel I've seen it compared to like The Parallax View or some other movies like that came out around the same time period, where everything is just very isolating and shit.
Yeah. One of the weird things Jenny just noticed is that early on in the movie, before the people even know what the hell's going on, about an alien invasion in the backgrounds, in the crowd, some of the people are just standing there watching the camera.
Yeah. You know? And it's like,
some of them have already flipped.
I never really noticed that before. I mean, there's so many, like rewatching it again, because I've seen it several times, but I hadn't seen it for many years. And rewatching it again for this review, I was just struck by all of these subtle little choices that they made. Philip Kaufman, who directed it, who he went on to do The Right Stuff. I think he did Henry and June, which is another great movie. Unbearable Lightness of Being, some other ones. But just him and the cinematographer, the way that they conveyed this just awesome sense of like dread and paranoia, they almost did, because I don't think, now I, please correct me if I'm wrong, they shot this in San Francisco, because that's Philip Kaufman was from there, and that's like his favorite city. And he just wanted to do a take on it that was more like an urban take rather than like the suburban take from the original movie. And he's just like, so they almost did like a guerrilla filmmaking type of thing. They didn't block off the streets or anything like that. And so it gives this real kind of sense that the camera is just like sneaking around, like watching the people. Yeah. You know what I mean? Which I think really, really adds to like the atmosphere.
Yeah, as the alien takeover starts to unfold, the main characters are starting to suspect something might be wrong. The Chinese launderer's guy comes up and goes, "My wife, that's not my wife." And they're like, "What?" "That's not my wife." It's just weird shit. And then later on, they're in the car driving, and a dude runs up to them on traffic trying to warn them, you know, "Something's wrong, they're taking over, they're taking..." And then a rage mob chases him down the street, and they're going, "What the hell's going on?" And then they drive around, and then they see him dead, hit by a car, and they're all standing around him like that.
Like, emotionally.
Yeah, just like, started off with a dude trying to warn you, and a fucking rage mob comes after him. It's like Twitter.
Well, that dude, well,
like a Twitter mob.
It was a call out, because that dude, that's Kevin McCarthy, and he played the main character in the original, in the 1956 movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, very iconically, when it was like, you're next, like right out across the bridge.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that was kind of like a cool little homage, almost like he'd been running around trying to warn people about the alien invasion for like 22 years or whatever. It's like, they're not listening to me. It's like the fucking aliens are coming. But yeah, I like too that you can't, I mean, I feel like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, it's one of those movies that, even if you haven't seen it, like, I think everybody knows the general premise of it. I mean, everybody knows what the pod people are and shit like that. So it's like, that's where the concept comes from.
Pod people are conformists.
Yeah.
They just go along with what everybody else is saying.
Right. And you know, everyone has had that feeling where you kind of feel like everybody is, you know, different from you, or you're like the odd one out, or whatever. So I feel like everyone can relate to it, which, like I said, is why there have been so many adaptations of it.
You go down to downtown Clearwater, the pod people are Scientologists.
Well, when I worked for them, I used to call them the pod people. Not to their faces, but you know, that's what we all called them, like behind their back. So yeah, you could definitely see that as a cult mentality. And I think the 70s one, maybe more than the 50s one, because like I said, I feel like the 50s one was, you know, more politically based. Yeah. But the one in the 70s, I think, was more socio-cultural, in the sense that, you know, one thing that that I thought was really cool, and I didn't really realize it until I rewatched this again, because I haven't seen it for a long time. I like that they cast everybody in the cast. Donald Sutherland, Brooke Adams is in this, Jeff Goldblum, Veronica Cartwright, you know, who the next year would go on to do Alien. They cast these people that are like kind of oddballs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're kind of like socially awkward. Like, some of the conversations they have are kind of weird and awkward. Yeah.
Jeff Goldblum's in this, and he's kind of a fucking outcast in a way. Intellectual.
Yeah.
People don't like him. So he kind of knows.
Yeah, he's a poet.
The reason why they did that is because they're trying to tell you that people who didn't fit in the beginning are the first to see it.
Yeah, well, because it's almost kind of like they're implying that those people are more human because they have all the human frailties and human, you know, they're oddballs, like, even in the context of their own society.
Yeah, well, they also understand the mass gestalt.
Yeah.
Because they've been against it, so they know it real well. When it changes, they're the first to notice it.
Yeah.
Because they're not caught up in it.
Yeah.
They're outside of it. Which I did really like that. Now, you said that the first one was more political, this one's more social. It's actually all the same. All right? Fucking politics, religion, and social movements are all different variations of the same thing in human behavior. It's that damn school, like a school of fish type mass mentality. That's exactly what they're talking about. It's all the same thing. Communism, Nazism, all the big different types of fascism, they were all mass movements. You know, essentially they were all the same. And it didn't matter the differences between the two, they were pretty much all the same. And that's what this movie's about. Just mass movements. Mass conformity. It's a threat to individuality. That's what it means.
Yeah. And that's why I think it was really smart for the casting that they did, because the people that they cast were very individual in the sense that they were very distinctive looking, they were very distinctive acting. They weren't, you know, like I said, they were kind of oddballs, even in the context of like a not alien invasion. Yeah. So they, you know, they were kind of like, left out of things a little bit.
They're inferring that the oddballs, because they never fit in, are the first to notice the change. That's what they're talking about.
Which is exactly what happens.
Exactly what happens. Yeah, that's the way it is in real life, too. It is true to life.
Yeah.
What they're talking about.
Yeah, so Brooke Adams, I think she's actually the first one to notice, because you don't... I love, too, that they're real subtle about when the invasion starts. I mean, the opening credits, like while the credits are rolling, they actually do, which I had forgotten about, but they actually do show like some other planet somewhere and these, you know, gelatinous microbial kind of...
spores. They're space spores.
Yeah, essentially.
That's what they are.
They kind of show them like kind of bubbling up on the planet and how they kind of come down to the... to the earth, like, you know, in the form of rain, and then these like little weird pod plants with these pretty flowers.
Which is real plausible, man. That's kind of like the mixture of the Andromeda strain, Slither, and the Thing.
Yeah.
That's all that same idea, that aliens could travel the gulf of space without spaceships. The first one that thought of that was actually H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah.
The old ones, they just traveled across space like spores.
Yeah.
Riding the solar winds.
Which is way scarier, because you'd never know. Because, like I said, they just show there's a shot at the beginning. Like, I think one of the first shots of the movie is Brooke Adams, like, looking out the window. And, you know, it's raining. And then they just kind of show these close-up shots of these little gelatin things, like, on leaves. Like, that looks kind of like rainwater, but kind of goopy. Yeah. And then, like, little tendrils start coming out.
Yeah, I guess it affected plants first and flowers. And it made its own version of a flower. And then it gets, tendrils get on you, and you become like a pod. And then, well, actually, it had to touch you. It's kind of complicated. It touches you and steals your DNA, makes a pod and a copy of you.
Pops out of the
copy pops out, and you who got touched by the tendrils, you're alive until you fall asleep. If you fall asleep, you never wake back up. Your body just disintegrates like an empty husk.
Yeah.
So once you get touched by those things, you can't sleep. If you sleep, you'll die.
Yeah, because it will take you over. And it doesn't,
well,
I don't...
kind of already did. It's that it's got something in you, remember? As soon as they fell asleep, they just fell apart like an empty husk. That way there's no original body to prove that you got copied, which that's a brilliant evolutionary adaptation.
That's what I mean. The more you think about the concept of this, the fucking scarier it is.
Yeah.
Because you would never know.
The spread of them goes unnoticed by the population that has not been affected.
Yeah.
But then they're a group mentality, kind of like the thing out of the Slither. They all know who's flipped, kind of. I think they can detect it, but they're not psychic, because you can fool them.
Because you can fake it if you're not. You can fake it. Yeah. I mean, they're essentially, when they take over a person... they take over their, you know, mannerisms, their memories and stuff like that. They just, it's almost like the soul or the, you know, the emotions. They don't have any emotions.
What they're talking about is in Eastern Europe and in the communist bloc back in the time that was this first story first came about, there were people in the communist sphere of the world faking it. They didn't believe it, but they had to fake it. That's kind of what they're talking about.
Yeah, because you're going to get your ass killed if you don't go along with like I said, everyone can relate to that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, so another thing that I love too, because you mentioned earlier that one of the things I noticed not only is the cinematography of this, just the way it's shot, they have like these strange, there's like Dutch angles, there's all like stuff is shot from just like bizarre angles sometimes, not to a point where it's distracting, but I also love too the way stuff is shot like down these dark corridors. Like it's almost shot like a noir film, but in color. You know what I mean? That was kind of one of the things they were going for. And like I said, even before you know anything weird is going on, you know, you can see people in the background, like people will be milling around acting normal, but then there'll be like a group of like three people that are just like staring either at the camera or at the characters.
Yeah.
And also I didn't notice this either, but there's also several shots of people standing by garbage trucks or dumpsters, and inside the garbage trucks and dumpsters is like this gray fluff, which you find out later is the husks of the old bodies. You know what I mean? So like the pod people, after they've duplicated the person and the original host body has disintegrated, they kind of just throw it out with the garbage, and it has been, so it's been there the whole time and you didn't realize it.
Yeah.
So the main characters don't realize until Brooke Adams' character, because her and Donald Sutherland are co-workers.
Yeah.
They work at the health department. She's more like a botany kind of person, and he's kind of does like restaurant inspections and shit like that. And she notices, she picks up one of the flowers because it's, you know, she, like I said, she's a botanist and she's never seen one like it before. And she thinks it's like really pretty and it smells really good. So she takes it home because she wants to study it and leaves it on the bed next to her, on her boyfriend's side of the bed. And then when she wakes up the next morning, the flower's gone. The glass is broken and her boyfriend's acting real weird.
Yeah.
Like he's acting like real... Just very cold and distant. Like, they can still talk, and they, like I said, they still have all the same memories and everything, but they're just very deadpan.
The thing that I really liked about the movie is that one of the main characters is Jeff Goldblum, and he's working, he's living and working in kind of a Jewish neighborhood, and he's working at a spa. Jewish guys are going to it, and he kind of has a not an enemy, but what would you call it? A competitor he doesn't like, who's Leonard Nimoy, who's another Jewish guy, and they're both authors.
Yeah.
And Goldblum can't stand this dude, just disagrees with him constantly. Goldblum is the first one to notice the invasion. And the Nimoy character, he doesn't see it. But over time, through logic and reason, I guess, he kind of becomes Spock-like. The Nimoy character says, I believe you, even though I don't have evidence. So he kind of makes that, did you notice that? Kind of makes the leap into faith to believe.
Although by that point, Leonard Nimoy has already been integrated.
I didn't notice that.
Actually, yeah. You don't know. I know it was before that point, You don't know. Actually, okay. Leonard Nimoy could have been a pod person from the beginning. Okay. Although there was kind of, I think there was a scene where he laughed and shit like that, which that wouldn't have flown. But the thing that's fascinating about Leonard Nimoy's character, I love that Philip Kaufman wanted him in this movie because he's like, you know, obviously he got typecast as Spock and he's like, I really wanted to kind of, you know, try to fight against that. But he also wanted to use the Spock character, you know, to inform the movie as well, because, you know, obviously it seemed like since everyone was kind of emotionless toward the end, it was almost like a Spock-like kind of thing. But Leonard Nimoy, he's like a pop psychiatrist.
Yeah.
He has this thing, which was all the rage in like the late 70s, I guess. Right. It was like shock therapy. And some of the stuff he said seemed reasonable, but some of the stuff was kind of nutty. And that was one of the reasons why Jeff Goldblum's character didn't love him all that much. Cause he said, oh, you know, all his views he has were like crap, but he was a best-selling author.
Yeah.
And he was trying from the beginning. He kept having these women, largely, that had read his books, and they kept coming to him going, hey, my husband isn't my husband anymore, even though he looks exactly the same, but he's not the same. And he started to, like, rationalize it. It was like a mass psychosis. And it's like, oh, well, this is just you women. Like, you want to get out of the relationship, and so you're trying to, like, make up this thing that it's like he's not the same person anymore. That's just, it's you. Yeah. So like I said, you don't actually know from the outside, like when he got turned, because that conversation that you're talking about
later on, I guess,
where they're at the top of the building and he says to Donald Sutherland's character, he says, I believe you because I've known you for such a long time. He's already turned by that point, because as soon as he leaves that meeting, he goes down and gets in a car with some of the other pod people. Okay.
See, the reason why I compared it to The Thing is because that shit's going on a lot. You're not really sure who's flipped or not.
Yeah.
I can go back and watch The Thing, and it's there are some guys I said, he must be The Thing, that one. You can watch it over and over again. You're trying to remember who was wearing what clothes, how much time had passed by. That,
which is kind of what you're doing in this one, too. It makes you super paranoid. Right, yeah. It's like really dreaded, do you think?
But I did like the fact that because of the director and the guys that were starring it and the time, the Jewish guy recognizes it first because they were the outsiders in mainstream society in the 70s. That's what they're talking about. And there was like a new breed of Jewish directors in Hollywood that were coming up, and they were making good money. Spielberg and Lucas were just right around the corner. This was what, 1977?
78.
Okay, so they were all, Lucas and Spielberg were already in the game. And that's why it's Goldblum, and that's why it took place in that neighborhood and everything. I thought it was a good touch.
Well, yeah, like I said, because, yeah. And like I said, all the characters too. I mean, Brooke Adams,
everybody was an outsider.
Brooke Adams technically was the first one to notice because she noticed the flower and then she noticed her boyfriend acting weird. Yeah. But the thing about her was that she was kind of quirky as well, like that weird fucking shit she does with her eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I guess that's like, it was pretty freaky.
Yeah, and that's the girl from, if you guys have seen,
she was in the Dead Zone.
Yeah,
later. I mean, she was in a bunch of movies. I think this might have been her first major film role. I think she did TV prior to this, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, she was in like a lot of movies in the 80s. But yeah, so, and like I said, Veronica Cartwright was in this as well, because her and Jeff Goldblum were like, they ran like a spa. So it was, they were almost kind of like, they weren't hippies, but they were kind of like new agey type of people. You know what I mean? So there was that whole thing going on. So as the story goes on, it's creepy too, because at first everybody's like, you know, my significant other isn't my significant other anymore. And everybody just kind of thinks it's a mass delusion at first. But then like a few days after that, some of the people that were saying that kind of came out and are like, oh, just forget it.
The Chinese guy did that.
Yeah, it's like,
That's not my wife.
But then a couple days later, he's like, oh,
no problem. That's my
wife. Shit, that's my... Yeah, so obviously he's been integrated as well. So it gets to a point where, everything starts closing in. It's like one of the creepiest scenes is where Donald Sutherland is like trying... Because, you know, they start finding, some of the... partially formed pod people. Jeff Goldblum actually finds one in the mud baths that's starting to look like him. So that's kind of why they figure it out. And then Elizabeth, Brooke Adams's character, she kind of starts to get integrated as well.
Yeah, that's the part I didn't understand though. They found the one that was looking like Jeff Goldblum. Did he sleep after that?
No, he fell asleep, but then he woke up.
Okay.
He fell asleep for a second, and then his pod person opened its eyes. Because remember, Veronica Cartwright was like, I saw it. It opened its eyes. It opened its eyes. But then when he woke up,
it was inevitable anyway, because you can't go without sleep forever.
That's what I was saying. And I was like, I think they kind of went into this more in like the 90s version and the later version. There's like, there would really be no way to fight this. Interestingly, the 50s version had kind of like a bullshit cop-out ending, because I guess it had more of a... more of like an ending like this one had in the 50s one originally, where it was just kind of like, because like I said, you would never be able to fight an invasion like that. Because one, you got to sleep sometime. Two, you wouldn't know like who to trust. So it would just be what they would call a soft invasion. So there wouldn't be any way to fight it. But in the original movie, they were like, the studios were like, no, it's the 50s. We can't have that bummer of an ending so they had to have a little bit of hope at the end. But this one, the 70s, they were all about the nihilistic endings. And this definitely has one of the best ending twists of any movie. And I've seen, you know what I mean?
Well, you wouldn't be able to fight this.
That's what I mean.
It's the same as The Thing. You wouldn't be able to fight The Thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's so fucking great. They go through all of this shit where it's like poor Donald Sutherland. It's like him and his girlfriend, Elizabeth, are like running away from the shit. She falls asleep finally because, like I said, as you would, you need to sleep sometime. And that's when the pods are going to get you. And there's so many fucking pods. They see this massive warehouse. They're growing them. They're putting them on ships.
Yeah.
They're going to, send them out worldwide and it's going to like fucking take over. So, even though it's probably a futile effort, he has to fight against it somehow, so he goes into the thing and like burns it down.
All it takes is a couple people in authority to become a pod people, and that's a wrap.
Well, and that's what happens is that about the halfway point of the movie, or maybe a little bit past, Donald Sutherland is like, hey, we're finding all these bodies, or I need to help Elizabeth. And this is kind of before he realized the extent of the invasion, how far it had progressed, because every time he calls like the cops or something, they already know his name. And it's like, and then he figures out that the more he calls to try and report shit, like that's how they find him. I mean, so they've just tracking them
they
down
know his name. They're like group mentality.
Yeah. Mr. Bunnell. And he's like, wait, I didn't tell you my name. What the fuck? And Jeff Goldblum's like, hang it up. Yeah. Oh my God, they're trying to find us. But, so he burns the thing down, but while he's doing that, Elizabeth falls asleep and gets turned into a pod person, which is a great, I love that effect where he's like hugging her and her face starts like collapsing. And then like the pod person pops up all naked and she's running around all naked and stuff. So he goes through all that. You think he's the only one left. Because at one point, like Jeff Goldblum and Veronica Cartwright's characters, I can't remember their character names in the movie.
Look, man, Jeff is skinny as shit in this. Just gotta say.
He's super tall, also. Yeah. But yeah, he's very gangly.
He looked like a scarecrow in this shit, man. That's a dude you need to eat. Eat your sandwich.
Well, he bulked out a bit later. Yeah. Because, I mean, like I said, this was
literally that
this
big.
Was probably like, was this, like 8 years before The Fly? He had bulked out quite a bit for that one. Because he worked out a lot for The Fly, because he had to do all that, you know, acrobatic shit. But yeah, so they go through all this trouble. You don't know. I mean, Jeff Goldblum, you find out that he got integrated because, you know, him and Veronica Cartwright's character, they took off like to distract. And while they were, so you don't know what happened to them. Jeff Goldblum turns up later on, and then Veronica Cartwright turns up later on, and she hasn't been integrated. And she's the one that tells them, hey, you know, I've been walking around with them. You can fool them if you just walk around and you act like you don't have any emotions and just kind of like follow them and do what they tell you. So she's been kind of like incognito. But then what happens, it's almost kind of like in Walking Dead back in the old days when they used to like put the zombie guts all over themselves and like walk among the zombies. So it's kind of like that. But then when they're doing that, Elizabeth, she like freaks out because she sees that dog with the person head. Which is one of the most iconic images from this. And you know,
it looks good.
It really does. Yeah. And it's like so, so creepy. I don't know how they did it. I don't know either, actually. I went on the Wikipedia page, but it didn't really. It was very vague about how they did it.
It looked like it might have been a photograph superimposed on a dog frame.
But its dog came. Yeah, it's like tongue came out, though. And it's like, I don't know. It was really weird.
Yeah,
it looks really disturbing. I mean, still, and it was like 1978.
Yeah, it looked pretty cool.
But I had forgotten.
The practical effects are good on this, too.
They really are. And this movie only costs like $3 or $4 million to make.
You could see kind of like the beginnings of, you know, like Alien and Aliens and all that kind of stuff coming. You know, they were good special effects.
But yeah.
That's something Spielberg would do.
Yeah, I mean, like when the pod people are, you know, when they're coming out of the pods, like the one, you know, when Donald Sutherland falls asleep and they start podding out and everything, that looks fucking great still. And that's, like I said, it's 1978. All practical effects. And they did them really cheap. I mean, they did them on the cheap, but it does not look like it.
Yeah.
Because like I said, they only had $3 or $4 million to make this, and they wanted all these, you know, all the actors that they wanted to be in it, you know, that was like a lot of the budget. So they didn't really have a lot of budget for special effects, but you would never guess it. But yeah, so the dog thing, I had forgotten. I just thought that dog was just like a weird random thing. But there was actually a scene explaining where that came from because it was the banjo guy. Oh, fun fact, that the banjo, like in the movie, that was played by Jerry Garcia. He wasn't in the movie, but he was the one playing the banjo. But yeah, so the guy and the dog, they showed them earlier on. And then at one point when...
He's a bum, right?
Yeah, when Donald Sutherland and them... it's like a street performer or whatever he was. And when Donald Sutherland and Brooke Adams are like running away, they see him and the dog sleeping next to one another. And then there's pods. And then I guess he like... Donald Sutherland like kicks one of the pods and like breaks it. So I guess at some point, like one pod took over both of the things.
Got confused.
And it got confused. It was like a Brundlefly moment.
Yeah.
So it's like, so I was like, oh, I'd forgotten that they referred to that.
I didn't realize that the dog could be absorbed.
Well, I guess it would be any
living
thing. Okay. Because another thing that I didn't notice too, until I watched it again, was that the score of the movie, which the guy that did the score, this is the only movie he ever scored. He did, if you notice, like, the sound at the beginning of the movie, you know, you can hear city noises and stuff, like garbage trucks and whatnot, but you can also hear, like, birds and stuff. As the movie goes on, all the natural sounds leave.
Okay.
And so, you know, so by the end of the movie, it's all those weird, like, unnatural machine-like noises and also the screeches, like, from the aliens and whatnot. But like I said, I think this movie... Easily one of the best sci-fi movies ever. One of the best movies of the 70s. And like I said, that fucking iconic ending where you're not sure, because they cut away from Donald Sutherland after Elizabeth dies. And he's back in his office and everybody's in the office. Everybody's doing their regular shit, like their regular job, like they would. But they don't, you know, they're not making any jokes or hanging out or anything. They're just being all pod people-y. And so you don't know for a second if Donald Sutherland is like faking it, you know, and he's still him. But then, you know, he's out in the street and there's all these weird, like, dead trees and shit.
That score that you were talking about at the time, to me, it sounded like a Cronenberg sound.
It did a bit. It did a bit.
I was going, man, it sounds like Cronenberg's work.
Yeah. And you can see, because like I said, this is a little bit of a kind of a body horror thing too.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then Donald Sutherland, he sees Veronica Cartwright, and Veronica Cartwright has not been integrated because she's been faking it like however long it's been. I guess it's just been a day or two. And she's all excited because she's like, oh boy, you know, it's Donald Sutherland, it's another normal person. And then he turns around and there's that really scary, like that pregnant pause. Yeah. And then he goes, bah! And you're like, oh shit. She's the only one left. It's like so fucking scary. It's just such a great fucking scene. But yeah, so we watched this on YouTube. I think it's free on YouTube.
Oh, that was YouTube? Okay.
Or it might be Tubi, but we watched we watched it for free.
Okay.
I think it was free on YouTube. And I think some of the other versions are on there too. I think the 1956 version, which is worth watching. I think this is the best adaptation of that book. Yeah. I don't know. Just everything about this one came together for me. I love the cinematography. I love how just it makes you paranoid, and it's just like it's dread inducing. Just the way that it's shot, it just feels so like you're being watched all the time.
Well, they're riding around these 70s cars, looking out the windows, going, what's going on? What's wrong? You know, it's just because it's a small group of people, and slowly the world is turning against them. You kind of do have that feeling.
Yeah, and it's everything is like kind of askew, you know?
Yeah, little details, people in the background watching them, stuff as they go by and looking at the camera. It's just weird.
I loved that. And I don't think I even noticed that the first time that I watched it. But this time it was like really apparent. Like they'd be going down a hall at their work and there'd be a guy looking out of the pebbled glass, like looking at them, like in the background. Yeah. I loved that.
At the spa, the bearded dude that came out of there, you know, remember the Jewish guy that was talking to the... Were they trying to insinuate that he had already flipped?
See, I think so, yeah.
Because he was staring at her and he goes, you're very smart.
And, yeah. I'm pretty sure that guy...
I think that guy was supposed to already flipped.
I could be mistaken, but I think that was Don Siegel, the guy that directed the 1950s one, I think. There's a lot of cameos in this. Right. Oh, Robert Duvall was...
Uncredited.
Uncredited. Well, he just happened to be in San Francisco, and they were like, hey, can you be in here? He's like, yeah, I'll do it.
Plays a priest on the swing set.
Which is one of the creepiest, because she just like finds the flower in the park like at the very beginning of the movie.
And he's looking at you.
And he's like on the swing, like with all these little kids, and priests and little kids, you know, that's never a good thing.
Looking at you.
But it's like just little details like that that just kind of unsettle you like right from the beginning. It's just like a brilliant, it's a brilliant piece of filmmaking, just the way that it goes. But yeah, seriously, pretty sure it's free on YouTube or it's free somewhere. But yeah, this is the best. The book's good too. This did a lot of different shit with it. But if you're going to see any adaptation, see this one. The 50s one is good too. That would be the second one I would recommend.
This is better.
Yeah, this one's better. I just think it's more broadly, it has more broad appeal, I think. It's more of like a generalized...
The edit's better.
That too. And it definitely has that creepy 70s kind of vibe to it.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind gone wrong kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Which I like that one too.
Yeah, you know what? We haven't done that one, have we? Holy crap, we need to review that one too.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely check it out if you haven't seen it. And we will see you on the next one. Bye.